Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast of Bruegel, the economics think tank based in Brussels. I am your host, Rebecca Christie. I am here today to talk about taxation worldwide with two of the most interesting people you will find to discuss this subject. We are lucky to have with us today Benjamin Angel, Director of Direct Taxation for the European Commission's Tax Division, and also Pascal Saint-Amand, who is now a partner at Brunswick and a non-resident fellow here at Bruegel, and who previously was the director of the OECD's Center for Tax and Administration. We are going to talk today about the state of play at the OECD on its global accord among about 140 countries to set corporate tax standards worldwide, and also about the European Union's progress in bringing its own rules and regulations into line with those and pursuing its other tax agenda. Pascal, can you start us off by walking us through the two-part OECD process and reminding everyone where we are today?
Yes, thank you, Rebecca. Let's step back just for 1 second, just to say that international tax has changed dramatically over the past 15 years. So you need to know about the history. Initially, it's based on a model tax convention developed by the League of Nations. This came to an end with the global financial crisis, which triggered a change and a kind of a revolution of international tax under the leadership of the G20. The OECD was holding the pen, and the European Union imported most of the measures, making them a hard law. So what happened is, one, the end of bank secrecy, and then as regards multinational companies, trying to patch a system which facilitated tax avoidance and which has culminated with the adoption of what we call a two-pillar solution adopted on the 8th of October 21, which provides for a pillar one, which is a reallocation of taxing right. How do you share the pie being the profits of multinational companies? There was an agreement on principle there, but now it needs to be translated into a hard law instrument, not yet done. And there was a pillar two, which was the adoption of a global minimum tax of 15% effective, meaning that multinational companies, which are large, above 750 million euros of revenue, can no longer have pockets of profits in countries taxing these pockets of profit below 15% effective. And this was adopted through a directive within the European Union, which has to be translated into domestic legislation by year end. So that's the landscape in a nutshell.
And the idea is to make sure that companies pay their fair share where they earn their profits and not set up shop in places around the world where they pay no taxes, right? Isn't that part of the problem, the perceived problem that people were trying to address?
If I may, and Benjamin will complete, but yes, and that was the decision taken by the G20 in 2012 to address what we call base erosion and profit shifting. The idea was to say there are massive profits sitting in tax havens where they are not taxed. I mean, $2 trillion of accumulated profit of American companies sitting in Cayman and Bermuda back in 2012. So that was wrong, obviously. Then the country said it shouldn't be there. And Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 are trying to say, well, the money shouldn't be in havens. So where should it be? Well, one, it should be taxed at 15%. And two, we need to reallocate the taxing rights so that part of the rent, the excess return of large multinational companies, should go to countries where the consumers are, knowing that the rest, the 75%, would be shared between countries where you do the research and development, countries of the headquarters, and other countries where some activities are performed.
Benjamin, the EU has been pretty ahead of the curve on putting this stuff into practice. Can you tell us where we are and where we're going?
Sure. The European Union has indeed been the first mover for Pillar 2. We transposed Pillar 2 via a directive which was adopted in December last year after a year of difficult discussion, let's put it like this. Pillar 2 was always challenging for the European Union because despite the popular perception, notably on the other side of the Atlantic, which tends to see the European Union as a uniform place of high taxes, in reality, we had around one third of the member state where the effective tax level was below the one which has been negotiated for Pillar 2. So politically getting an agreement that this should be addressed via a text of union law setting rates and a floor of 15% was certainly challenging, but we managed. The transposition date for Pillar 2 is the 1st of January, so we are nearly there. We have had an unusual approach as regards Pillar 2. Normally, when a directive is adopted, we do something else. We wait for the transposition by member state, and then we check the transposition. But Pillar 2 is an extremely complex animal. By definition, when you try to build something among so many different countries around the world, it's a difficult task that we had to literally take the member states by the end. So since January, we have gathered member states every 2 weeks, more or less, to discuss in common all the questions related to the transposition of this directive. And to give you an idea of the complexity, we have received more than 400 different questions from member states, more than 400. We have tried to come up with common interpretation, so we hope that down the road, the risk of wrong transposition by member states or incorrect action should be reduced. Most member states have now almost finalized their legislative process. There will be a few member states late, unfortunately, a few a bit late, one or two a little bit more than a bit late. We're still discussing with them to try to make sure that they can catch up as quickly as possible. But the political will to make it happen is still there. It's rock solid. And it is transformational for the European Union and for the rest of the world.
Can you tell us anything about the holdouts? Can you tell us who's slow? Are they the same countries who were reluctant when we were getting the deal done? Or are they different? Would you say technical constraints or political constraints?
It's not uniform. The country which runs the risk of being very late is among the countries that flag political concerns, that's Poland. Primary reason they put forward is that we're having an election in the autumn. Everyone can have its own opinion on the argument. We have nevertheless some other countries which are late for the same reason. That's typically the case of Spain, which has been late on a number of legislative fronts just because it was very difficult to have any legislation passed in Parliament. And then you have a small group of member states which will have a very small delay of a few weeks, which is basically immaterial for running Pillar 2. The key is that the member states which are late catch up as soon as possible and are able to exchange information with the others. The problem with Pillar 2 is that it works a bit like a jigsaw. You need all the different pieces to be able to do a correct calculation. So when you have the information missing from some large markets, you run the risk of having some mistakes in your calculation. That's why it's essential that we keep on accompanying the effort of member states to make sure that they're on time and particularly on time for the exchange of information.
We see in the tax industry some frustration among accountants that the US and EU rules are different and they foresee some difficulties in coming up with bills. Is this something you've heard about or something you expect to be challenging when it comes to, say, calculating the top-ups or other ways of making sure the companies are really paying the 15%?
The question for me or for Pascal?
I can quickly come in and Benjamin will follow. It's not a slight difference. It's a fundamental difference between what the US has done and what the OECD has done. The US has adopted a global minimum tax in 2017. And the OECD has adopted, with the support of the UN, a global minimum tax of 15%. The GILTI, Global Intangible Low Tax Income by the US, is a minimum tax of 10.5%, but which is looked on an average. So if you have a US company doing business in Cayman and in France, half and half, you will take the average between the two rates, which will be probably around 12.5 and so you're not impacted. Why the global minimum tax by the OECD is very different, it looks at jurisdiction by jurisdiction. If you have a pocket of profit in Cayman, you will take the difference between 0 and 15%. The US failed to implement the OECD deal. So we're in a situation where you have a global deal not implemented by the US, nor by the way, China. However, I can hear the objection, all this is funny, it's just the European Union. No, it's enough of a critical mass of countries to implement this global minimum tax for it to have an impact, thus the importance that it took for the European Union to implement Pillar 2, because with the European Union, with the UK, with Canada, with Korea, with Japan, you have this critical mass of countries, which means that all companies in the world will be subject to the minimum tax, including the US companies and the Chinese companies, because they are doing sales in a large market, which is the European Union.
Indeed, I have a critical mass of countries. We have more than 50 jurisdictions in the world which are actively implementing Pillar 2, which is a good basis. But more important than the absolute number of countries which are implementing it, you have to keep in mind that the primary purpose, as Pascal has explained, was also to have a floor to tax competition. And in that sense, Pillar 2 is clearly delivering. You have countries that were zero tax jurisdiction, which have announced in very clear terms their intention to introduce a corporate income tax for the companies in scope as of next year. That's the case, for instance, of Barbados. That's the case of Jersey, that's the case of Guernsey, that's the case of the United Arab Emirates, which was one of the biggest zero tax jurisdictions in the world. So the transformational effect I was mentioning is happening. And we clearly have now, for jurisdictions which were very problematic in the past, a floor being introduced to the corporate income tax, which is good news for everyone, including developing countries. Because very often Pillar 2 misportrayed as something which was pushed by a club of rich countries. But what people tend to forget is that you can be Germany or France or UK and have a relatively high tax rate and still be competitive and attractive. Because by definition, attractiveness for foreign direct investment is due to many reasons, and taxation is just one of them. If you're a tiny island somewhere in the Caribbean and your neighbor is introducing a 0% tax, you are under a hell of a pressure to do the same. Or your capacity also to resist a large multinational trying to arm twist you into a sweet deal was also close to zero. Now we have an international floor to tax competition, which protects the tax income of the developing country by making sure that they cannot be arm twisted into a level of taxation which do not guarantee the minimum revenue mobilization that they need for their development.
People have said that the very fact that the U.S. has any kind of minimum tax did a lot to make this politically possible, even if they haven't implemented up to the deal. Do you think they deserve some credit for that?
The answer is yes. The U.S. merits credit for having made possible a global minimum tax. I mean, when we worked on BEPS, I mentioned that it was the base erosion and profit shifting work started in 2012, 2013. Nobody thought that we could ever have a global minimum tax. The US tabled the idea. It was the Obama administration, which had no majority in Congress, and everybody laughed at the proposal. And the big surprise came from the US tax reform under Trump back in the second half of 2017, where the US lowered their corporate income tax rate from 35% to 21%. But to fund that, they had to broaden the base massively. And they implemented the BEPS measures, different BEPS measures. They say, that's not enough. We need to go beyond. And going beyond meant the adoption of a global minimum tax, GILTI, global intangible low tax income. And you may appreciate the pun and the irony of calling a minimum tax GILTI coming from Republicans who usually are not big friends of taxes. The fact that they made it possible gave ideas to European countries which said, we love it. We want the same. So can we multilateralize it? It happened in the past with FATCA, which is a Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, putting an end to bank secrecy. And that European country said, well, we want to multilateralize that because we want the same degree of information from Switzerland and other bank secrecy jurisdictions. And it happened with the global minimum tax. The US made it possible. The irony of that is the Biden administration tried to tighten GILTI and move from this global blending to an approach country by country. They pushed that at the OECD. There was this global deal with 137 countries on the 8th of October 21. And now the irony is that the Biden administration was not able to implement, but the agreement was such as if the US fails to implement, other countries will be able to collect the minimum tax on American companies, which would leave some pockets of profit in low tax jurisdiction, because it's a two-way street. And that's what is infuriating the Republicans, who said, well, that's a deal which was reciprocal, as if this was really bad. And from an American perspective, it's bad that something is reciprocal. Usually it's unilateral.
When we come back, we will talk about the other half of the OECD deal, which specifically looks at digital companies, many of which also have strong American presences. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. Pascal, you were just starting to talk about how Americans are uncomfortable sometimes working in a multilateral environment. Can you give us a brief background of the digital services tax, the trade fight that ensued, and how this got us to Pillar One of the OECD deal?
We all know about the digitalization of the economy, and we all know in Europe, at least, the frustration which arose from this digitalization, with countries saying, well, you, Google and the likes, you're deriving massive profits from our territory, exploiting the data that you collect for free from our people, but the sales are booked in Ireland and not in the large markets where they are generated. Because of that frustration, back in 2013, when we started the work to fight base erosion profit shifting, there was an action dedicated to digital. So countries said, we're going to do what we can. What we can is a transaction tax on digital services, 3% on the gross income derived from France or from any other country. And the French tried to push for a directive. It failed in the European Union because there was no unanimity. You know that the decision-making rule in the European Union on taxes is unanimity. But when the Trump administration did the tax reform and allowed for discussion on the global minimum tax, but also on how we could better share taxing rights, because the Americans at some point thought of changing the rules to tax more at the destination where the consumers are, which is exactly what the Europeans or some Europeans wanted to do on digital, tax where the consumers were. The conversation resumed, and the Americans said, you cannot take unilateral measures against our companies because that's a revenue grab against American companies. If you do that, we're going to take trade sanctions, but we can negotiate a global agreement. And the global agreement you had, you know, like with the rest of the Trump tenure, you had the roller coaster, some progress and then stop and go. And the Biden administration said, okay, we need to sort it out. We want something multilateral. And they came to that deal, which basically says companies, the largest ones, above 10 billion euros of revenue, 10% profitability, will have to reallocate to where they sell their stuff a portion of their rent. The rent is defined as above 10% profitability, and the portion to be reallocated through a formula is 25% of the rent to be allocated to where the sales take place, whether there is a physical presence or not, which is what we call a new nexus. That was the deal. Now, this deal would require a multilateral convention to be implemented. The multilateral convention is almost ready. The draft is out, but the US said, I cannot sign unless I have the views of my business community, which will be provided on the 11th of December. And the big question that everybody has is, okay, even if the US signs, can Congress ratify? Because you need two-thirds majority in the Senate for ratification. So I think with that, you have the picture and big questions for policymakers like Benjamin on what happens next if the US doesn't ratify.
So Benjamin, where do we stand in the EU, where some countries have digital service taxes but have not been expanding them or implementing new ones while these talks are underway?
Well, the four member states which have a digital service tax, that is France, Austria, Italy, and Spain, still collect the money. And actually, the product of those digital services tax has very strongly increased in the last year. So it moved from being relatively anecdotal to being not anecdotal. All the EU member states have subscribed to the OECD deal. So in that sense, the four countries having a DST have committed to roll back their DST once Pillar 1 enters into force, which itself calls for a critical mass country joining it. Critical mass, which is calculated in such a way that it cannot enter into force without the participation of the United States. As Pascal was saying, the big question is, will the United States be able first to sign and then to ratify it? On the first point, I think it's positive that the Biden administration has taken the time to engage with Congress, even though the time that was asked by Secretary Yellen is more than what we had in mind initially. At least she has asked for consultation until June next year. We have to see what the outcome of this consultation will be, because if you spend 6 months in discussion with Congress, the likelihood that the Congress asks for nothing is probably not very high. Some element could be taken into account probably without some difficulty. Some may prove to be more challenging, but time will tell. We should not doubt the will of this administration to sign and ratify. But the difficulty that we have been facing from day one is the fact that part of the Congress has expressed skepticism towards Pillar 1. Actually, surprisingly, originally we had a lot of skepticism Pillar 1 and a vibrant support towards Pillar 2. Then in the last 9 to 10 months, the opposition to Pillar 1 has a bit diminished. I would not say that it has turned completely, but it's not as vocal as it used to be. While we have heard this time more and more critical voices to Pillar 2, which we did not expect originally. But the American businesses are slowly moving in the right direction. The digital company have always supported Pillar 1, not because they love Pillar 1, but because of the counterfactual, which is they don't want to see an avalanche of GST everywhere, which are basically uncoordinated with different format, different rules, and which lead very often because of this lack of coordination to double taxation. But so far, the brick and mortar company were not supporting Pillar 1, which they see as a very complex animal, which clearly it is. And they are slowly waking up to the political reality that if there is no deal on Pillar 1, very clearly a large number of jurisdictions will introduce DSTs. We have 19 countries in the world which had DSTs in the pipeline that were told pending the outcome of the OECD negotiation. If you have DSTs, there is a substantial likelihood that the US trade representatives start trade procedures against some countries. This is exactly what they had started against the former EU member states having DSTs a few years ago before we called a truce. If they start trade procedures and take trade sanctions, by definition, trade sanctions call for countermeasures. And the countermeasures, they are not in the digital sector. They can be anywhere. So with all its flaws, Pillar 1 bring something which is extremely precious, which is a cooperative way to agree on how to share tax base globally, and trade and tax peace. In that sense, any failure of Pillar 1 could potentially lead to significant international tension. And this is the primary reason why the European Union remains very firmly committed to doing whatever it can to ensure that Pillar 1 sees the light of the day.
Has it been hard to keep everyone moving together? For example, the Italians regularly talk about wanting to increase their digital service tax because, as you point out, it's non-trivial now. It's actually bringing in money and they need that.
By definition, countries are free to take their own decision. But Italy is among the countries that support very strongly Pillar 1, and I would not imagine that the four member states, I think the DST, would take now any decision that put at risk the agreement which has been reached internationally. Actually, if you want to see a difficult discussion related to DST, there is one, but not on this continent. As you know, there is a very visible difficult discussion taking place in North America with Canada, which is legislating for introducing a DST and therefore not respecting the general commitment to have a standstill. They are still willing to withdraw this DST when Pillar 1 starts operating, but they primarily say, why can the French or the Italian or the Spaniard have a DST for as long as Pillar 1 is not there and I cannot?
And there's frustration with how long the process is taking. We also saw in North America at the UN some developing countries saying that they would like to have a larger voice in tax talks. There was some frustration that they did not feel sufficiently heard in the OECD process. Pascal, do you think this resolution is going to change the way that countries work on international tax agreements? And is it going to help or hurt or be on its own track?
Quick comment on what was said just before, which is that, yes, there is frustration, but Benjamin is right. The only good solution is a multilateral solution. And everybody knows that, but people are trapped sometimes in their own rhetoric, in particular in the US. Companies are supportive, but not all, and we'll have to see what happens. I think the fact that the US is doing a consultation, in a sense, is good because it will oblige American companies to say, what do we want, war or a multilateral solution? And this multilateral solution was designed in a way to be bipartisan from an American perspective. Very few companies impacted, 150 companies overall in the world, which should limit the opposition, and tech companies are very much in favor. Now, the frustration is big from emerging economies, developing countries. That's why, after years of negotiation at the OECD where they think they didn't get enough, they are trying to push for the UN. They are trying to push for a new world where they would have more of a say, so be it. Except that what cannot be agreed at the OECD cannot be agreed at the UN either. So what's very frustrating with this UN push is that it was done with a lie or another promise, but more a lie than promise, which was, oh, a global deal can happen at the UN when it cannot happen at the OECD. Some things could happen at the UN, like setting up an agenda which would reflect the priorities of developing countries. But these priorities are not about a global deal on the reallocation of taxing, right? Which will not be that different from what was agreed at the OECD. There are many other things, simplification of the rules, withholding taxes, and other measures like the taxation of the natural resources. So the UN rise, we just have to hope that it will not damage the progress which was done, which was impressive. Those who wanted to push for the UN trashed the work of the OECD to just serve their agenda of bringing the UN to the fore. I think that was a mistake because you cannot campaign on something which is wrong. I mean, criticizing the progress on the end of bank secrecy or even on BEPS, these criticisms were unfair. Now, I hope they will build something which will not undermine the progress made at the OECD. So you can hear some bittersweet comments on my end on what's happening in New York.
Benjamin, would you like to add anything?
Yes, we have coordinated a common EU position in the UN discussion, which de facto went a bit beyond the EU because the candidate countries tend also to align the position which are taken by the European Union. So basically, we shaped the vote of around 35 countries. Our position was that we were open to developing the role of the United Nations in the tax field, but provided it does not overlap or duplicate with the important work that Pascal and his team have been developing over the years. It is all the OECD effort. This position has been defended by the European Union. It has been defended by the United Kingdom, by the United States, by Canada, by Australia, by New Zealand, Japan, Korea, plenty of countries. But the UN work with one state, one vote, and here clearly we failed to rally a sufficient number of countries. Now we have a resolution which has been voted quite clearly from a numerical point of view. I think the vote was 125 against 48. We have to consider what the next step will be. To be fair, it's not very clear what the proponent of the resolution are after. They tend to mix a number of elements, and the NGOs themselves in their presentation tend to spin some of this element and present the opponents as a group of big bad wolf. So if it's about, for instance, fighting illicit flows, I don't think that anyone has anything against making progress on fighting illicit flows. What we don't want is a reopening what has been done at the OECD in boosting tax transparency with thousands of tax treaties now in this field. It is to be reminded that the last OECD agreement on Pillar 1 in July is now subscribed by 145 countries. I mean, that's 3/4 of the UN. This is not ridiculous. And this is an open process. Countries keep on joining this agreement. So what would be the value of starting everything all over again, apart from a giant waste of time?
I gather the supporters of this resolution want some kind of talks to open within the next year, but what those talks will be trying to achieve is not yet clear. When we come back, I'd love to bring the discussion back to Europe to talk about a few things that might be coming up closer to home. As we close out this podcast, I'd like to take a minute to talk about the EU budget. Digital services taxes, or a digital levy, was supposed to help pay for own resources for the EU budget. But now, something like this is not going to happen at the EU level, as we've just heard, and it is currently at a standstill at the national level. So, Benjamin, where do we stand in terms of finding new own resources to help pay for things?
Well, some are already agreed. There is, for instance, an agreement on adding the carbon border adjustment mechanism as a new own resource. It does not bring a lot of money, but it's not intended to bring a lot of money. As you know, CBAM is here primarily to incentivize third country to introduce carbon pricing and third country producer to reduce their carbon footprint. So we're very happy with the idea of having less money even in the future. ETS is becoming an own resource, and ETS should bring a very substantial amount of money. Now, it was discussed between Council and Parliament that in principle there should also be an own resource which is based on some corporate taxation element. I think the idea of digital levy has been ditched already a few years ago, the minute we got the certainty that the OECD was making sufficient progress to arrive to a deal on Pillar 1. We floated the idea of making BFIT, our new proposal for a framework for corporate income tax of multinational, notably, and on resource. But the discussion on BFIT will start only around the end of the first quarter next year. They will be long, they will be difficult. They are very uncertain on whether we manage or not to reach a compromise on such an ambitious project. And therefore, the Commission has also proposed a temporary measure, which is an own resource, which is based on a statistical aggregate, which is the gross operating surplus of corporates. It is not that we are taxing the corporates themselves, to avoid any misunderstanding. It's really the statistical aggregate based on this that would be used for calculating the own resource. The discussions are ongoing, and as you can read in the media, these are not easy discussion. So it's hard to make a prognosis on what will happen with own resources.
ETS is, of course, the emission trading scheme. Pascal, where do you see the long-term future of this going?
I am finalizing a paper on own resources for Bruegel. So soon we'll have a summary of all that. A couple of remarks. One is the money today is in CBAM and the ETS. That's clear, and that is what is to the scale of paying back the debt of next generation EU. As regards corporate income tax, I think Benjamin has been very clear, and he's absolutely right. There is no immediate prospect of having a Pillar 1 type of resource, which is this allocation of digital taxes or part of the Pillar 1. However, what the Commission recently did put on the table as an amended proposal, not yet discussed, and there is an issue of timing here, but a statistical resource based on corporate income tax or based on a proxy of profits. So it's a statistical, a bit like the VAT or the GDP, the GNI, but this one is linked to a tax base, which is a proxy of corporate income tax base. I think it's a smart move. BFIT is not yet there, and then Benjamin carefully indicated that it's going to be started only in terms of discussion in a few months, so probably years before it's adopted. But having a proxy which is on corporate income tax, I think is a good one because it rebalanced the impact of the own resources from the CBAM, which was more heavily on the Eastern European countries. Like here, it's more on the bigger Western European countries or Ireland and the like. So more balanced and, better to move on this now rather than on promises of harmonized direct taxation, which may not be for now nor for tomorrow. So the long term is carbon taxation. That's what the attention will be in Europe and elsewhere in the years to come. We could see recently an op-ed signed by the president of the EU Commission together with Ngozi from the World Trade Organization and Madame Georgieva from the IMF to say, now it's time to put a tax on carbon. So let's look into that.
Pascal, any closing thoughts as we wrap up this episode, The Sound of Economics?
Well, many things still happening. I mean, we've been through a revolution. International tax was boring until the global financial crisis, which brought a fundamental change, which introduced tax cooperation, which is a real game changer, including with this global minimum tax. But there are still tensions between the North and the South, if we want to summarize it that way. And we need to be careful that these tensions don't translate into pure rhetoric. That's the risk at the UN, where the decision-making rule is majority. So you may have a majority of countries thinking this and a minority, being a majority of the world economy, thinking that. I think that would be a mistake. So we now need to try to find common grounds and don't undermine all the progress made on tax cooperation.
Benjamin, where shall we leave it?
I would certainly agree that the progress which has been done in the international tax field over the last decade has been absolutely spectacular. Much has been done also in the European Union in the field of direct taxation. 20 years ago, there was almost nothing. Now we have 14 directives and one regulation. And as we speak, we have 6 directives which are under discussion in the Council. So it's fair to say that a lot is happening in the tax field, and the widespread perception, which has dominated for a long time, that it was doomed to fail because it's too complicated, because it's difficult to get unanimity, etc., is just wrong. It's not because you need unanimity, be it in the EU or consensus in the OECD, that you cannot manage. It certainly called for more sweat and tears, and also attention to strike the right compromises. But the willingness is there, and the benefits attached to the development of international cooperation in this tax field at the OECD and EU level are very substantial for everyone, businesses and citizens. So the direction of travel is clear. And we hope that the commission that will come after the European election will continue its efforts and also continue to support the important work which is conducted by the OECD in Paris.
Thank you so much for that. Thank you, Pascal Saint-Amand from Bruegel and Brunswick. Benjamin Angel joining us from the European Commission. I'm Rebecca Christie, Senior Fellow at Bruegel and Europe columnist for Reuters Breaking Views. You can find all of Bruegel's podcasts and reports and event recordings at our website, bruegel.org. And you can find The Sound of Economics on all your favorite podcast channels. Thanks for tuning in.